Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.
This is Gerard Gibbert, and thank you for listening to Middays here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Middays with Gerard Gibbert is on the air. Middays with Gerard Gibbert is powered by CSpire. Power your home or business with CSpire fiber. To learn more, visit supertalk.fm/CSpire. CSpire fiber powers Super Talk Mississippi.
Get ready to go beyond the headlines and join a meaningful conversation with people from around the state. You're listening to Middays with Gerard Gibbert here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Everyone, and welcome to Midday Super Talk Mississippi. I'm your host, Gerard Gibbert, along with Rhino in the Element Wealth Studio, guiding you through the middle of your day with facts, fodder, and fine music. Morning there, Rhino.
Howdy, howdy.
We got the Votorama Marathon, whatever you want to call it, going on up there in Washington as the Senate deliberates. Described as the most deliberative body in the world. They're deliberating the One Big Beautiful Bill Act presently. That's after Democrats demanded that the bill be read aloud in the chamber, all 940 pages of it. I was a little surprised. That means it shrunk by about 100 pages out of the House. It's a mere 940. Come on. And so that process is a bit interesting in that multiple clerks of the Senate rotated in the reading of the legislation. You could catch some of it live from the streaming facilities. Did you notice there's like nobody there? Isn't that shocked? Aren't you shocked, I should say?
Well, I mean, senators couldn't be bothered to actually learn what's in the legislation they're voting on.
Unbelievable.
They got other stuff to do. Lobbyists to meet with, dinners to attend.
Well, they read it all out. That's where they are. And now it's time for the amendments to be offered and the vote to occur. I've seen some interviews this weekend with members of the Senate and House on the Republican side, of course, who said, yeah, I think we're on track to get this thing done by the July 4th holiday. That's sort of a self-imposed deadline. The president's kind of serving as the whip in chief, is he not? I know. Boy, he got all over old Tom Tillis, the senator from the great state of North Carolina. A bit of a moderate, I think it's fair to say. He expressed significant concerns about the bill. And it turns out, and the president said, we're going to primary you. I don't remember exactly how he phrased it. But Tillis kind of surprisingly comes back and says, okay, I ain't running again, for what that's worth. So two senators voted against the bill from a procedural perspective. That's the way it works. They have a vote to just say, okay, let's get this thing onto the floor and let the Votorama commence and all the sparks fly. As you know, the Democrats are going to go one by one to the well, and you're going to hear a litany of sob stories like you ain't ever heard before. You're already seeing it. I'm going to talk about that some today. But two senators on the Republican side of the aisle voted against the procedural vote. That would be Rand Paul. He made it very clear, the senator from Kentucky. He was a nay from the get-go. And then it's Senator Tom Tillis. Ron Johnson came around. He's expressed concerns about the spending and what he believes to be the lack of a serious effort to address the country's deficit and debt. Rand Paul said this thing's got a debt ceiling increase of $5 trillion in it. I'm a nay. And Tom Tillis' objection, a little different. He, the senator, of course, from North Carolina, he's concerned about cuts to Medicaid. There are some other Republican senators who have expressed their concerns about that as well. Jim Justice from West Virginia, he's also expressed concerns of how this will affect the rural hospitals in his state, which has many, by the way. So Ron Johnson from Wisconsin initially said, I'm a nay, but then they pushed him over. Just a motion to proceed. I mean, that's all this was. This wasn't voting to enact the legislation. This was just a vote to say, let's put this on the floor and let the debate begin. So that's where we are. By the way, Vice President J.D. Vance, he traveled to the Capitol, did he? He was kind of in the dressing room, right? The back room there in the Senate. Just in case he had to come out and break the tie. Was not necessary. Had one more senator from the Republican conference voted no, we would have ended up with the need for the vice president to cast the deciding vote. That did not happen. So here's where we are. It's on the table and out in the open for everyone to view. And the Senate now is debating it. Now, so I got to start with this. Related to this, I consumed a lot of videos and articles and statements and press releases from Democrats and surrogates, pundits, activists. The fear-mongering is absolutely outrageous. What really galls me more than anything is this notion that we're cutting these programs to give tax breaks to billionaires. That just, can I just say it, pisses me off. Is that okay? Because it's not only inaccurate and misguided, it suggests that the more economically successful in our society are obligated to pay for all this swath of benefits the federal government doles out. You're obligated to pay for it. By the way, it's not your money. It's ours, says the government. We just let you keep some of it. That's the way they see it. Not that you legitimately earn this by serving society. No, you didn't. They believe everybody that ever achieved any degree of wealth in this country did so illegitimately. Nobody ever did anything, which is completely false, 100% false. But this notion that one member actually made this statement, paraphrasing it a bit, that money is being transferred from the people who are recipients of these benefits to billionaires. That, like, they're literally, someone on Medicaid is literally transferring dollars out of their bank account to a billionaire. That's what they are implying with this statement. And they go through, Rhino, these monetary values. It's going to cost people in this income range this much and that much, as if all this is cash. Medicaid's not cash. SNAP's not cash. Do they cheat and convert it to cash? Absolutely. I know people who have reported, I personally hadn't witnessed it, seeing this exchange go on like in the parking lots of grocery stores. Is this true?
Oh, yeah.
Where they're like selling their SNAP benefits for cash money.
Going rate's usually 2-1.
Okay. So you got Medicaid.
For $50, you get $100 in SNAP.
And you got Medicaid and SNAP. There's also some changes to so-called dual recipients of Medicare and Medicaid. This would be low-income people, low-asset people in the Medicare program, old people, that also get Medicaid benefits based on that. And there's some changes in that as well, which are valid changes, like this idea that you got to work if you're an able-bodied adult to receive benefits. And by the way, rather than checking in Medicaid recipients once a year to approve your eligibility, you got to do it twice a year. Because you know this is they game it to hell and back all the time. Here's my income today, wink wink, put me on Medicaid, and then the next day they got some super high paying source of income, like another job which they didn't tell them about, and they live on it for a year. And they're not really eligible anymore. So checking in, that's just disastrous to Democrats. We're coming right back with Haley Fisackerly, President and CEO of Entergy Mississippi.
This segment of Middays with Gerard Gibbert is brought to you by Covington County Hospital in Collins, where your health matters.
Now back to Middays with Gerard here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Welcome back, everyone. A little Huey Lewis in the news bumping us into this segment of Middays. We're in the Element Well studio welcoming now Haley Fisackerly, President and CEO of Entergy Mississippi. Haley, always good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning, Gerard. Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to come and talk to your audience and our customers.
Yes, sir. You bet. And I'm one of them. Yes. And a happy customer as well. So we appreciate all the great work that you and your team do. So you guys have been busy. You're in the process of constructing significant expansion in capacity and transmission to accommodate this unbelievable investment in terms of new economic projects in our state, specifically in Madison County, just a few miles north of our location here. We've got Amazon Web Services slated to build out two hyperscale data center campuses. And, of course, critical, essential to that project was your company's ability to meet their electricity demands.
Oh, that's right. Gerard, it is exciting, and it's something I like to tell people. AWS threw us a lifeline at a critical time when we're going to have to make significant investments in serving our existing customers. A third of our generation was set to retire in the next few years. We have to make huge investments to better serve our customers, both reliably and through resiliency due to storms. And this opportunity, thanks in big part from Madison County and the leadership they showed and the governor and others to help bring this, it is happening, though. It is amazing. I drove out there just last week, five buildings already vertical, and we've already provided power to them now. And so they're slowly ramping. They're not do that. As you're familiar, it's a it phases in, three phases over 3 years. So phase one, their buildings are up. They're putting the equipment in. Phase two is under construction on County Line Road. And so a lot. So it's definitely had us busy. We delivered the first substation 2 months ahead of schedule this past December and started ramping power to them in February.
Okay.
The second substation on the Costas property is under construction now, and the third one back at Canton is also started clearing of that land too. So very busy. We broke ground on the Delta Blues power station in Greenville, and now we're working through a process to get a power plant approved in Ridgeland right now as well.
Okay, so I didn't realize you guys were already providing power to those buildings.
And a very slow ramp.
Okay,
it's a ramp over time and all that, but they are they are hooked up and slowly ramping up.
Yeah, so.
And providing benefits to customers.
Oh, that's fantastic. So you're probably aware that this project proposes 16 buildings total at this point.
Yep.
We think there's going to be a lot more. I know you're aware of that as well. But at least for now, 16 buildings, about 250,000 square foot facilities each building. There are two different sites. One, as you just mentioned, at the Costas property here in Ridgeland, or just north of our location in Ridgeland, across the county line there. And then the other further north in Madison County in Canton, the Canton mega site, 16 total buildings. You guys are investing a bunch, though. I mean, do you know right now, Haley, what the total capital investment will be for new generation and transmission?
Well, this one will just be just over close to $3 billion between all of it.
Okay.
Now, the thing that we're investing, and people need to understand, AWS is paying the incremental cost to serve them. And so the huge benefits that our customers are getting, for example, the transmission lines serving those sites have to be upgraded to larger standards, more and more resilient standards to improve the flow of power into this metropolitan area. Those substations that have to be built to serve those are being paid incrementally by the customer. They are capital investments in it, but the tariff, the rate that they're paying through that covers those incremental costs, but it creates the economies of scales.
Yeah.
That's going to create the huge benefit to the rest of our customers, and that's a real benefit there at a time where we need to make significant investment to improve service.
Explain that, Haley. A little further, you're aware that there are some who have expressed significant concerns about possible rate increases to just a standard consumer to offset what is, I guess, been reported at least as a significant discount to AWS, that in fact the consumers are going to have to pay to offset that discount you guys are selling power to AWS for.
Right.
Talk about that.
Well, keep in mind, large customers like this, large volume users, you know, they do get a rate discount because of volume.
Yeah.
But their total contribution because of the volume is tremendously great. So keep that in mind. But like a second of all, they do pay the incremental costs, the parts that do not benefit the rest of the customers to serve themselves. So on top of that, when you get that type of volume coming in, though, the rest of the benefits of that and the cost that they do contribute toward benefiting other customers. The legislation and the requirement the governor, the lieutenant governor, the speaker, and the Public Service Commission required is that they cover the incremental costs and provide extra economic benefit to customers.
Okay.
So what we're seeing going forward, they will be providing of the investments we were going to have to make to serve our customers regardless of AWS, they're going to be covering over 50% of that going forward.
Okay.
And so, like the Delta Blues plant, and we had to build that. Now, with a large customer, they're going to be paying a larger amount of the freight to cover that, which is going to produce that. And so, after we see – now, rates are going to go up, but we have seen the trajectory of future rate increases cut in half because of AWS's presence going forward on that. And that's going to be the huge benefit providing our customers and allow us to start making the investments – to better serve our customers and communities.
So at least one detractor, however, has described the legislation as giving Amazon Web Services essentially a blank check to buy electricity from Entergy. Is that the case?
No, that is not the case. We, after the legislature passed the legislation, then we had, and we knew the parameters and what the law says, then we sat down to negotiate the contract on this, these first three phases, and these first three phases only. And that's where these parameters were addressed. This is where the cost, the incremental cost that they have to pay is addressed, and the benefits they provide to customers through rate stabilities that we're able to give our customers and make those investments. There is talk about could they do more? Yes, they bought plenty of land. That anything beyond that is a separate deal.
Okay.
So there's no blank check. This is tied to those first 16 buildings, and if there's any more beyond that, well, they have to meet the parameters as laid out by that legislation and provide value to all customers.
The Public Service Commission, of course, regulates the energy utility industries in our state, and it's being reported that the PSC has no oversight over this particular project. Explain that for us.
Well, that's the part that makes me a little nervous, because that's not true. What's different is they had to speed up the front end part. You know, for this opportunity to come to Mississippi, if it could not have been delivered in 3 years, it was gone.
Yeah,
it was
that's gone. Right.
So how do you speed up through the permitting and review process? So it granted the convenience of necessity that we need a certificate of convenience and necessity, CCNs. But every project, each substation, each transmission stuff, each power plant, every one of those, as they are completed, they go in front of the commission for a prudency review. The legislation allowed the PSC to hire a third-party independent to review those.
Okay.
If they find anything improper or imprudent, it can be disallowed.
Okay.
Under old processes, we would have that agreed upon and approved before we would go make those investments. Under this process, to accelerate this prudency has to come on the back end. And so that's a little nerve-wracking. So we're going to have to do a lot of work on the front end to prove and show what we're doing to manage the costs and finding the best processes going forward.
So, Haley, are they bringing in third parties, and did this come about because of just the scale, the magnitude, the complexity of this? It just makes sense to bring in folks with a greater set of expertise to be involved?
Keep in mind, the Public Service Commission is very busy, and
that's, sure.
And their staff are constantly doing their day-to-day work of regulating the retail utilities in the state. So when you bring this extra burden of work in, it provides them additional hands, because it is incremental, right? These filings will be made that. We also have to provide reporting throughout the year to the staff and the commission on the progress of these projects. So if anything, it provides more oversight. There are lots of projects that have come to this state in different parts of the state. You've never seen anything that has as much scrutiny as this one does.
Okay. The assertion that the legislature repealed Entergy's ability to raise rates by more than 4% per year.
No, that's they did not repeal that. We have what we call a former rate plan. It's performance-based rate making. And at any time during the course of a year, if revenues exceed by 4% the previous year, they go in for a review.
I see.
They are bringing so much revenue in, their revenue exceeds the 4%. And a good example, we had a former rate plan that just went in front of the commission just 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Just off of the forecast we're seeing it, for the first time in 6 years, there was not adjustment under the former rate plan.
Can you hang with us another segment?
Sure, you bet.
We got a break right now. We got Haley Fursackerly, President and CEO of Entergy Mississippi, coming right back in the Element Well studio.
From the sea.
You're listening to Middays with Gerard Gibbert, here on Super Talk Mississippi.
We're back in the Element Well studio. Haley Fursackerly, President and CEO of Entergy Mississippi, is our guest. So, Haley, you've seen reports across the country where this massive build-out of data centers, which are, of course, huge consumers of electricity, have caused rates to go up in certain areas. Virginia is one that comes to mind. There's a huge concentration of data centers there. But it looks to me like, on all the research I've done, I want you to comment on this, that the power companies didn't properly plan for this explosion, and now they're kind of caught with their shorts off here.
So true. I mean, this happened so quickly. You know, when we first started talking to AWS 7 years ago, it was really just around data storage.
That's right.
And the whole machine learning AI came after that. But you hit the nail on the head. We were not a first mover, but we were definitely we were the second mouse that got the cheese. We were able to see that. And I think the legislation – the process and the policies we put forth in there allow us to capture these opportunities, but at the same time do in a way that truly benefits our customers and our communities and protects them. I mean – this is transformational. It's generational. I mean, just based off, as you know, the $10 billion known, it was estimated that nearly $80 million in ad valorem taxes. to Madison County. Never mind the fact the investments we're making are going to be in five other counties.
That's $80 million a year, folks, by the way.
$80 million
a year. Yeah.
And we're making investments in power plants, solar facilities, transmissions in five other counties. And now, not nearly as big, but
yeah,
still incremental ad valorem taxes that are going to be transformational to schools and infrastructure locally. And
yeah,
so it's a real opportunity.
Okay. Well, are you prepared then to say here, Haley, that you don't expect that there will be any significant rate increases as has been asserted out there in the public as a result, direct result of this AWS project?
As a direct result, no. You know, rates were definitely going up, but as I said, because of bringing this new customer in, the volume, it changes that trajectory.
Okay.
And so rates will not be higher than they otherwise would have been.
Yeah.
And because we're dealing with fluctuation, you know, we saw steady increases in our rates since post-COVID because of materials, supply chain, inflation, labor costs, things of that nature. And this past year, finally, we saw that trajectory just change.
But as a regulated utility, you can't increase rates without the PSC approving it,
exactly,
right? And then this past year, I think I just read not too long ago, you did not request a rate increase. Is that right?
That's correct.
For the next year.
For the next year. So the first time under our former rate plan, it did not. And so, you know, there's lots of things that hit the fuel costs or a dollar-for-dollar pass-through. And so you've seen natural gas prices go up. And that's a significant part of everybody's bill. Nearly 50 cents of every dollar just goes to pay a fuel bill.
Okay.
So that will cause fluctuation. Weather changes the amount you use that. Taxes, regulations, and material costs.
Yeah.
We've definitely seen that. But one benefit that did allow us by this project moving as quickly as it did, in 1 year, we have seen components on power plants increase by 50% because of this nationwide demand for turbines and equipment. And so by moving early, we were able to lock down the supply chain on that and given huge customers. Because like I said, we were going to have to build this plant anyway. Because of AWS, we were able to move more quickly with it and provide those benefits as well. So it's a huge benefit. We're seeing demand, too, though. It's not just data centers. We're seeing onshoring, manufacturing. We're seeing a way we use power, electrification. We're a more connected society and world today. We
no
carry
doubt.
Devices today.
All our homes are all wired up to the hilt with all kinds of stuff, which is a good thing.
And every time you hit an app on here, it's generating more use. If you're using AI-generated searches, they're going to use 10 times more electricity as normal.
Yep.
So we, the consumer, are changing that, too. We could have sat back and said, hey, you know what, so what? We're going to we got to make these capital investments anyway. You got to take it, customers. No, we decided how do we find something transformative that moves the needle and can partner with our customers and communities to help reduce the cost to serve.
Okay. In the new investments you're making, Haley, to accommodate, you said you had to do it anyhow, but my guess is the scale of that probably changed once you knew you had AWS coming in, right?
So. Right. Well, we have to build more hardened facilities, storm resiliency stuff. The incremental things to serve them are going to be the substations, the solar facilities that they require. They want to be served by solar.
Yep.
Those things are incremental. The power plant that we needed here was going to be needed to serve our customers going forward because we were retiring units that in the future that had to be replaced. Our customers didn't need all of them, but now they have a partner in them, and we can build them at economy scales here that provide huge benefits to that going forward.
Makes sense.
It's a real win-win for our customers.
So you talked about natural gas. Are you going to power these facilities with gas turbines? I know that's kind of the more common way and more modern way of producing electricity these days, meaning your main source of energy will be natural gas. Is that true?
So keep in mind, when any customer is served, they join the grid.
Okay.
So, yes, we are adding more gas generation. We're adding solar. We have nuclear on our system. All of those things are in that, and it's in a pool, and you pull from that pool to meet your needs. So, yes, the incremental investments we're making are in some gas units, solar facilities. We had the opportunity to also acquire additional output out of Grand Gulf that belonged to one of our sister companies under a sharing agreement.
Yep.
That's been turned over to Mississippi, and we picked up that incremental load there. We have a partnership with Cooperative Energy helping us meet some of the capacity as we ramp up and build our our new unit. So it was a real partnership there and doing that as well to make sure we're protecting customers and meeting the needs to grow.
So if the president's policies do affect the way it is expected, we might see the price of natural gas continue to decline, which would be good for the cost of generating electricity. Is that true?
You know, it's interesting. I thought, if you look at, I think you're going to have upward pressure, Gerard, if you think about it, because there's so many gas units being built all over the country right now. LNG facilities are being built and upgraded. Our sister companies in Texas and Louisiana are serving two of the largest LNG facilities that are going through massive expansions to export natural gas. So I think it is going to have some pressures. However, I was at a conference just a few weeks ago, and the head of Occidental and also some other executives from the gas industries and commodity experts were forecasting what I thought were, you know, 50 cents to a dollar type increases. Now, you know, that is still some, but I still think of the days in the early 2000s when we saw $10 and $12 in MMBTU.
Yeah.
Forecasts now are in that $4 to $5 range, okay, which is still up. But the units we're building are more efficient. So the Delta Blues unit is nearly 50% more efficient than the one it's retiring. The one we're retiring is at a 14,000 heat rate. This one is less than 7,000. So you get more output with less gas. So that creates a huge efficiencies and savings to customers, too.
And there's also efficiencies in the IT gear as well. You know, AWS has said, hey, look, because of advances in power draw technology of all this equipment, we're going to be able to install more equipment and still draw the same amount of power, which is good for us because that means more ad valorem taxes and more investment and so forth.
Exactly. I saw where NVIDIA projected that they could see a 90% improvement in efficiencies in those. What you mean is they're going to just be able to put more processors into those
more
buildings.
More dense, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
So concerns that you've heard in the public about solar, talk about that and how that's consuming land and just other issues people have with it.
Well, you know, I've definitely heard that. You know, a lot of people think of it's impacting agriculture, and you're seeing some of that happen. It's starting to plateau somewhat now, I think, economics. The big, beautiful bill is going to have a huge impact on that when the production tax credit's there. But so far, what we've been able to do, for at least from our side serving our customers, is where it makes sense and when customers are willing to pay for that incremental cost.
Okay.
And that ensures that it's done in the right way. You know, we're still paying the ad valorem taxes, seeking a slight fee in lieu. There are some counties that have been using the full 90% that the legislator granted.
Yep.
So they probably won't see quite that, but at least it comes at the bottom end. But it does provide those benefits. But I think the concern is not as great as people should have, you know, and I think the contracts behind them, the way to build these in a way that's responsible and also to clean to decommission them later in life are there.
Still being debated, but are there any provisions, Haley, in the big, beautiful bill that could translate into higher rates for Mississippians and for your customers?
Well, for example, into our forecast, under the previous law, you have production tax credits around nuclear, around renewables. The power plants we are building will be using carbon capture capabilities. There's production tax credits for those. There's various supply chains. There's excise taxes if certain percentage of your supplies are foreign owned.
Yeah.
That's concerning because I appreciate trying to drive onshoring, but right now a lot of the materials come from foreign countries, so those excise taxes could drive our costs up. That's concerning. So we're trying to watch it all. It's still in the sausage making process, and we'll see where it shakes out.
But before we go, when it lands, if that necessitates a rate increase legitimately under our law, you still got to get approval by the PSC, right?
Still has to review. We have to show them why those.
You have to justify it.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And that's outside the that's a normal course of business.
That's just being a part of a regulated utility.
That's right.
Yeah. Haley Fisackerly is the president and CEO of Entergy in Mississippi. Thanks for coming in, Haley.
Thanks, Gerard. Yeah, appreciate it. Thank you.
We're coming right back, folks, in the Element Well studio.
Need heavy haul?
You're listening to Middays with Gerard here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Welcome back, everyone. It is Middays, Super Talk Mississippi on the C-Spire text line. Does the CEO see an investment in more nuclear power energy, such as smaller units throughout the grid? Well, I've talked to Haley about that before and others. You know this, Rhino. It's in all the above energy strategy, and nuclear will play a major part in the future, I believe, of energy generation and transmission in this country. And small modular reactors, you and I have talked about that numerous times, will play a significant role in that. Now, the concern of the energy, the energy companies, is that private companies would install these SMRs to power their facilities, thus negating their need for connection to the grid. So it's kind of a catch-22 deal there, but that's coming. There's no doubt. There's a data center operator, you guys can look it up, called Switch Networks. They're now a public company. And we did a little business with those guys back in my business days at their facility in the Reno, Lake Tahoe area. I think about 3-4 million square feet of data centers across multiple buildings up there in the mountains. And they weren't even connected to the grid. All of their power was derived from wind, solar, and geothermal. Now, they happen to be located in an area geographically where it's possible to produce power with geothermal. So that is a concern, but yeah, it's an all-the-above strategy. And you also heard Haley say that through some agreements they have with other power companies outside of the state, that they're able to tap more of the power produced by the Grand Gulf nuclear plant to service Mississippi, and this increase in the demand for electricity as a result of these big projects. So yeah, and I know someone said solar isn't reliable during weather emergencies. Right. I think everybody gets it. You see that stated over and over and over and over and over again. We get it, except it still does have a place in the matrix. And there are many companies that are requiring a certain amount of renewable. Is it a complete replacement for more totally consistent, reliable, persistent power, such as gas, oil? No, it's not. I don't think it ever will be. But does it have a place?
Not until we reach a battery technology that can
store it. Yeah, and that's improving every
power
day.
That's not needed on sunny days for rainy days.
I totally agree. But there are some areas of the country where it don't rain, that you could drink up the sun's rays and produce energy, such as in Nevada. You know, they have a lot of days with sunshine. Here, not so much. Little bit dicier proposition, no doubt. But just as a part of the overall matrix, sure, makes a little sense when it's done with common sense. I don't want to go start tearing down farms and agricultural land to install solar panels. That doesn't make any sense whatsoever. In fact, I would argue that's detrimental to society. But there's a lot of land that's not suited for agricultural production. And perhaps it makes some sense there. But as a complete replacement, no, we're not even close. The left thinks we are. And they'd like to see us completely end the consumption of all fossil fuels, which just ain't going to happen. That's just dumb. Might happen at some point, but it's not in view today for sure. And what Biden wanted to do in California, like by 2030, I don't remember exactly what the goals were, but it was such that California would be largely dark a lot of the time if they achieved those goals, those renewable energy goals that dumb Gavin Newsom had put out there. So no doubt, it's going to question What's going to happen in Satarsha, John in Hazelhurst asks. That gets asked a lot, and there's nothing official on that. I have an idea. It's not a data center. It says, is that a data center? No, it is related to the energy industry. I'll just tell you that. From what I know about it at this point, and that's somewhat secondhand, but I think it's fairly reliable. It's related to the energy, and I think that's going to be great. Where is power going from the wind turbine farms around Tunica? I don't know. I suspect, Rhino, that's just being pumped into the grid itself. You heard Haley talk about that. All these various sources all are pooled, I think it was the term he used. They all connect into the grid and transmit down those wires to every address. So it's just kind of all collective. We're stepping aside for a break. It's Middays from the Element Well Studio. We got one more hour remaining today. It's Monday. That means it's a short show. Coming right back.
Hour of Middays with Gerard Gibbert is brought to you by the Mississippi Business Journal. Visit msbusinessjournal.com. Scott Coopwood, publisher and president.
And now, another hour of the talk that keeps Mississippi talking. Middays with Gerard Gibbert.
Begin your transmission now.
Now on Super Talk Mississippi.
Welcome back, everyone. It is Middays. We are live in the Element Well Studio. It's Monday. That means Super Talk Outdoors comes your way with Ricky Matthews at 12:05 today. The Dow up 184 at this moment. The 10-year is trending downward. That's good news for borrowers. 4.263%. The president, man, he did an interview this past weekend, Rhino, with Maria Bartiromo. He likes her a lot because she's able to score lots of those one-on-one sit-downs with him. And, man, they talk the gambit. That's the one thing you have to at least applaud about the president is without any teleprompter or notes or aides or anything else, he'll talk about anything. And he's very forthcoming, very direct. Doesn't beat around the bush. I like that. I just think that's a result of his business experience. But once again, man, he laid into O.J. Powell at the Fed. He says that the benchmark rate should be in the 1% to 2% range instead of the present 4% to 4.5%. The concern, guys, is that we've got a significant amount of our debt, I think the last I checked, it's like $9 trillion of the 36 and change that's due for, it's terming out later this year, due for refinancing. We don't have the cash to just go pay it off, unfortunately. And we're adding to the debt on a daily basis. But refinancing it means we're going to have to refinance it at higher interest rates because this is older, longer-term debt that is going to be retired, and we have to go borrow money at new rates, which means our interest costs are going to go up, already approaching $1 trillion a year. Think about that. $1 trillion a year of just interest. That's mind-boggling when you consider we have a $7 trillion budget. That's, what, roughly 13% of our total spending goes to interest costs. It's now larger than the amount of money we spend on defense, which I believe is a core function of government. So as long as the rates stay elevated as they are now and the Fed doesn't push down the benchmark rate, the cost of that financing, that debt, is going to go up when we refinance about $9 trillion. Darren in Jackson asks, who do we owe this debt to? Believe it or not, contrary to popular belief, mostly ourselves. Individuals, financial institutions, intergovernmental debt, we owe ourselves. Most people think, I don't know if it's most, but I would say it's certainly popularly believed that we owe foreign countries. Foreign countries account for about 25% of total outstanding debt. And then, additionally, most believe China is the country of all the foreign countries that holds the most U.S. Treasury debt. Not true. It's Japan, sitting at about $1 trillion. China, we owe not an insignificant amount, currently about $700 billion. They're number two. And there's a host of other countries as well that own our debt. But we mainly owe ourselves. I mean, it's Americans. It's American government agencies. It's individual investors. It's institutional investors. It's banks. All the above. The Fed. All the above. That's who we owe. Lisa in Clara, Mississippi, where's the power going from the wind turbine farms around Tunica going? Again, I don't know specifically. I may have already said that, but into the grid. I don't think that's dedicated to servicing any particular entity. I think they're just pushing it into the grid. And there are laws around requiring utility companies, right, to buy it. It's not the dollar for dollar in Mississippi. It is in some states. I think it ought to be dollar for dollar. I know we've lost economic development projects here because companies wanted to produce their own power and they had done the math and determined they were going to produce more than they needed for their own purposes and they were going to sell that into the grid. And they opted for Arkansas because Arkansas buys dollar for dollar. Can't remember the term. There's a term for it in the energy industry that refers to that concept of the energy companies buying.
Net metering.
That's it. Net metering. Thank you. Yeah. So, for example, if you set up some sort of power generation at your house, like solar panels.
Well, I mean, the best example would probably be what the Public Service Commission did away with and then brought back was the Solar for Schools program, where if your school wanted to invest in solar panels to, say, cover the teacher parking lot,
yeah,
or put them on the roof of the school buildings, then they could sell that power back to the grid to lower their power costs.
That's right. Generate a little income there. Absolutely right. But the net metering, the dollar for dollar net metering, is something I think we ought to consider here in Mississippi, honestly. It's a fraction of that. It's not the full dollar for dollar in Mississippi, as I recall. Mo says, as long as I can get fuel for my generator, I'm keeping it. But I'm interested in a solar-powered battery pack in case we can't get fuel during an extended outage. That was a question. You're right. The solar for schools. Let's see. Dan in Hattiesburg, are they experiencing pushback over solar farms? Well, it's not just the energy companies that are building solar farms. There's other entities that are doing that. Yeah, there's some concerns. Certainly around here in central Mississippi, there's a very controversial one in Hinds County. And I think there's even been town halls, right, Rhino held recently. But this is more of an issue with the county government, I believe, and the residents than the energy companies. Let's see. Yet still, there would be a rate increase indirectly passed on to consumers. Well, it's either direct or it's not. I don't know about indirectly. I'm not sure exactly how you would do it indirectly. But I do think the fact is these massive investments being made in more power generation and transmission achieves more economies of scale. And in doing so, it doesn't mean rates go down. It just means, as you heard Haley explain, they don't rise at the trend expected had this investment not been made. And there's no doubt, just like our water infrastructure, the electrical infrastructure, it's aging as well. It's got to be modernized. And when you do that and you rebuild it, yeah, cost of doing that today is a lot more than it once was, especially when you're importing all this stuff that's subject to tariffs that are necessary and only available presently, at least. So Haley made a good point, though, that we got in front of that because of these projects. A lot of this demand that we've seen for more power, which has driven up the cost of all the components and the elements associated with building new power generation and transmission, we were able to get our projects done, and they secure their contracts for all that before a sharp increase was realized on these products and services. So I think that's good news.
You just got to remember that the most vocal opponents of all this growth in the Mississippi economy are usually dyed-in-the-wool Democrats that haven't had their heads screwed on straight for years.
And that's disappointing, because aren't you guys tired of being 50th in the nation in household and per capita income? I am. Number one problem in the state is poverty. Well, the only way to fix poverty is to grow the economy. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean, unfortunately, that the people who are impoverished in our state improve their personal situations because they go to work and they have more opportunity. There's more to it than just that. But what it does do, and that's the goal here, is perhaps improve upon our stagnant population growth. So not only do we have stagnant population growth, Rhino, the people who have the more prospect of earning more in our state, they leave. What we're left with, the people who remain here, I'm talking in a general sense here. I'm not talking about everybody. Don't get me wrong. However, are just the continuous cycle of those that are already impoverished producing more people that generally end up poor. What we need is to retain more people and attract new people into the state that are producing more and thus more affluent in nature. That lifts up everybody's prospects. We're stepping aside for a break. We're coming right back in the Element Well studio.
Be sure to tune in at
Middays with Gerard Gibbert.
Let's do this.
Right. On Super Talk Mississippi.
Let's go.
We're back with you in the Element Well studio. So the Votorama's going on the big, beautiful bill right now. Amanda from Pike County, we were talking earlier about the fraud around the SNAP program, food stamps specifically. Why are we bringing that up? Because the big, beautiful bill does include some provisions that would reform the program. There's nothing specific about addressing this type of fraud, but Amanda says, I've also seen people at the big store with a W in it buying big quantities of snacks and diapers. They go back to their government housing and set up a store.
And that's the more honorable among them.
Yeah. I mean, and that's
why you saw so many snatch and grabs in the major metropolitan areas of blue states, especially those that saw spending limits put on them, a.k.a. shoplifting limits, where they would just go steal a whole bunch of stuff that they knew they could sell out of their house.
Yeah, totally true. And that's something that, you know, you'd have to have an army of people to detect this. I'd have to think through if there's any way we could use automation to identify those situations. We're not going to be able to hire enough. We don't want to hire a bunch of people to go to police all this, honestly. We just need honorable people. Unfortunately, there are too many that think they're not only entitled to these benefits, they're literally entitled to the cash they generate by illicitly using these benefits, right? That's the fundamental problem in this country, is that the Democrats in particular have just championed this idea. We saw it especially, Rhino, after the George Floyd situation up there, when the whole world freaked out and we had all the BLM riots and every dead gum corporation in America went and spent gobs of money on all these stupid racial sensitivity training and CRT consultants and all that crap. But a part of that narrative was, you're entitled to this. They're ripping you off. They're screwing you. It's the billionaires' fault. They're the ones that caused all this. So it's okay if you go steal. I'll never forget that young black lady that we played the sound. Remember, she was, I believe, in Minneapolis with a store behind her that you could tell had been ransacked by the rioters. If they go in there and steal Gucci purses, well, that's okay. That's reparations. And I'm not saying it's all about race, because it's not. There are a whole lot of people across the racial spectrum that are abusing these programs and believe they're entitled to the work product, the assets of others. And now we see this playing out in New York City with this lunatic kook, Zoran Mamdani, who over the weekend, you may have caught that, he says he wants to impose and shift the property tax burden in the Big Apple to the suburbs of where the white, wealthier people live. Basically, he wants to,
quote, shift the tax burden from overtaxed homeowners in the outer boroughs to more expensive homes in richer, whiter neighborhoods.
So not only is he a Marxist lunatic, he's a racist.
That's in bold on his platform blanks.
Tell me how that's not racism.
Oh, I'm sure people on the left would spin it as not having a power dynamic because whites cannot be the victims of racism because whites hold all the power in a systemic racist fashion and blah, 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 blah. More justification for their nonsense.
And it is true. There are many of these race hacks.
Yeah, race pimps.
That say it's not possible for racism to occur where a white is the victim. Is that right?
Yes.
They'll just tell you that. They're like exempt from it, so to speak. Well, the other thing he said,
they are the same people that will say there's no such thing as domestic violence of a woman hitting a man.
It's true. Or that,
because they don't live in reality.
Or that pedophilia shouldn't be a crime, right? Same loons. Same wackos. I hate to say it. You're right. I hate to say it because I'm part of this generation. It all stems from the 60s hippie nuts that are running around dreaming all this crap up, right?
Yep.
Mostly a bunch of white liberals with purple hair.
Or silver hair.
It's true. But big glasses and stupid clothes on, right? Yeah. I hate to stereotype like that. I really do. I try not to. But it's just too often, it's like,
well, they wear the uniform of nonconformity.
And that's the problem. It's a badge of honor to them. So this nutcase that's highly likely to be the mayor of America's largest cities, he said over the weekend there should be no billionaires. He sounded like Bernie Sanders. Isn't he the one that said that in the past? There should be no billionaires in this country. Hey, dude, newsflash. No capitalism, no billionaires. There ain't no city for you to be the mayor of. Has he not thought about that?
No. He's not thought about a lot of things.
Good gosh, man. I hope they all leave. Now, I know a lot of people say we shouldn't be recruiting, or we should be at least concerned about recruiting some of these people, these companies, these organizations into Mississippi because they may bring their politics with them. I got to tell you, folks, I spent a lot of time in New York in my business career. There's a whole bunch of people up there that think just like we do. They just get drowned out. There are actually more registered Republicans in New York than there are people in Mississippi and California. We looked it up. That's who we want to come here, and they think like we do. And they're worried about this nut. He's going to sure enough kill the golden cow.
It's not the C-suite that's the bleeding hearts. That's the marketing department.
Correct. Correct. And so now you've seen the governor of New Jersey, which is a bastion of liberalism. Hey, come move to New Jersey. Who would have ever thunk it'd be better to live in the most unionized, highest tax state in the damn country? He's right for doing that. He's laughing about it. Just move across the river. Many, of course, already live there. So we want, you're right, we want the CEOs, we want the people who think like we do, who are proponents of capitalism and just common sense normalcy. There are a bunch of them in New York. They live in New York because it's the financial capital of the world, among other things. That's the lifestyle they enjoy. But this guy's going to run them out. He's going to kill the golden cow. They don't get it. It just disturbs me. But this is all about these concerns about the big, beautiful bill. Just I'm so tired of hearing all these leftists just across the spectrum. It's all focused on health care. Everybody, I mean, if you listen to them, Rhino, everybody's going to die. There's not going to be any health care. I mean, that's the fear-mongering that they are advancing.
Oh, yeah, Klobuchar was in tears on the floor crying about how her dad might lose Medicare.
Oh, my gosh. All because you got to check in twice a year to make sure you're still eligible? Please explain to me why that's a problem. What we should do is create automated systems that check it around the clock, real time. And the minute you're ineligible, I'm sorry, you're not eligible. You're gone. Is that harsh? Is that cruel? Is that inhumane?
It's what we'll eventually have to do when we're out of money.
Because not only do we not have it, we can't hire enough people. I mean, I support these frequency eligibility checks, but the fact is, that's going to take more people, more time. They're saying, oh, the paperwork requirement's onerous. How much paperwork do you have? No disrespect here, and I hope this doesn't come across the wrong way, but if you meet the eligibility requirements because your income does, how much paperwork do you have? We're not talking about a wealthy person with a 3-inch tax return here. Right? I mean, what could there be to that? Just incredible that they're griping about that. No, we don't want you to check eligibility too often because you might find out they're not eligible. Oh, man, I get fired up. I'm sorry about that, folks. But it's the truth. I just can't imagine why they're pushing back. Well, I do know why they're pushing back on it, because they think they get political power for this. And this fear-mongering crap about you're kicking grandma off their Medicaid, like Klobuchar with a bunch of crocodile tears. What a joke.
Well, she's been a joke her entire adult life.
You know what I would say? Why don't you go take care of your dad? I'm sure that you're of the means to do so. Why don't you take care of your family member and quit relying on the government to do it?
Because in the halls of Congress, family members aren't family. They're political props.
Certainly for Klobuchar. Disgusting.
She's not the only one.
No, unfortunately, you're right. We're stepping aside for a break. We got half an hour of middays left. Stay with us.
From the Seabrook Paint.
Middays with Gerard Gibbert.
It is on.
On Super Talk Mississippi.
Welcome back, everyone. A little Three Dog Night. Really cool. Appreciate that. Rhino, good music there. So, old Robert Rice He, of course, had to weigh in on the big, beautiful bill. He said, leave it to the Democratic Party to snatch an existential crisis from the jaws of electoral victory. The stunning success of 33-year-old Zohran Mamdani, a self-described Democratic socialist, in the race for New York City mayor is causing anguish in the Democrat Party. So he's mad that there are some Democrats who are upset that this guy is won the nomination to be the mayor of America's largest city. It's one thing for Trump to call Mamdani a 100% communist lunatic. The president accurately described Mamdani. That's to be expected from the Bulgarian-in-chief. Isn't he so cute? It's another for Matt Bennett, co-founder of the centrist Democratic group Third Way, to warn that Mamdani's affiliation with the Democrat Socialist of America is very dangerous. Dangerous for whom? Bernie Sanders, who nearly won the Democratic primary for the 2016 presidential election after announcing he was a Democratic Socialist and probably would have won the Democratic National Committee had they not torpedoed him. Unbelievable. So, clearly, old Reich supports, there's more to this lengthy post here. Clearly, he supports this nonsense, this loon.
Well, he's a little communist himself.
That's exactly it, man. It's just.
And I don't know which word to put the most emphasis on, little or communist.
Unbelievable. So, this is what bothers me, though. You know, I told you I always like to scroll down and read the comments from his followers. And one here says, I 100% agree, Dr. Reich. The Democrats need to embrace urbanism and democratic socialism policies, such as universal health care, tuition-free higher education, paid maternity and paternity leave, subsidized child care, increasing minimum wage, and guaranteed vacation time. And that got over 1,000 likes.
From the gimme, gimme, gimme moochers of society.
This is what concerns me more than anything, is that there's so many people in this country that support this nonsense. It's not Mamdani. It's the fact that there are a lot of people out there that also support that, advocate for these policies. Enough for him to win. That's what we have to be on the lookout for and have to fight back against. I don't want this country to turn into a socialist wasteland. And if you think there are other countries that embrace some of these policies, are better off than we are,
you're lying to yourself.
Big time. Big time. And hell, they're all being destroyed by the invasion of illegals that they're making legal, by the way, in their country.
Yeah, is it Denmark that's having to raise their retirement age because a majority of illegals there are taking early retirement?
Yes.
The actual Danish people are having to retire later to pay for the immigrants to retire early.
Boy, if that wouldn't grind your gears, I don't know what would. I think this is another comment. I think David Hogg faced the same reaction. In my opinion, both of them are the future of the Democratic Party. So this nut is saying Hogg and Mamdani. That got 1,800 likes.
No, Hogg got ran out of the DNC because he had the temerity to try to reach out to young men.
Right.
And the Democrat Party is not the party of young men. Unless you're gay.
Especially masculine young men, right?
Point stands.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. So masculinity to Democrats is toxic. Yet we celebrate
dudes in dresses.
Yeah, oh yeah, they're held up on a pedestal. They're so brave.
Except for the one that took pictures in the Disney bathroom, they're going to get in trouble.
Oh, my gosh. And then there was a video I caught of a big Pride event. By the way, today, that's the last day, Pride Month, right?
Yep.
Oh, my gosh. Why do we have a whole month of this to call attention to someone's sexuality? Who the hell cares? Only the people looking for attention.
That's all they got going in their life. They're miserable in every other aspect. They're probably miserable in their love life, but at least it's strange enough to get them attention.
Guys, there's a video going on yesterday, big pride event in Texas. I can't remember the town. I couldn't believe the language, the vulgarity, the obscenity, with kids all over the place. I couldn't believe it. In Texas.
Had to have been Austin.
I'm thinking so. Now, again, you have a right, of course, to act like a fool like this. That's what makes this country great. But surely you're crossing some line when there's kids present and you're doing this stuff, aren't you?
Oh, they killed shame in the Democrat Party a long time ago.
Unbelievable. Thomas and Greenwood, not happy about the big, beautiful bill. You're sick of the Democrats. What about the Republicans who are abandoning their principles to support it?
So and when voting this, with the Democrats? How is that principled?
Right. So when this bill passes and next year spending is higher and the national debt is $40 trillion, what will Republicans campaign on? They can't campaign on fiscal responsibility and the vague assertion that it would be worse with Democrats. So there's no doubt that this legislation as written is going to boost the deficit and debt. No doubt in my mind. Now, I also agree it is going to boost economic growth. I'm convinced of that. As I said when Haley was on, Haley Fisackerly from Entergy, Mississippi, that I think making permanent the immediate expensing is going to be huge to economic growth. I really do. I've seen some market analysts even pegging the S&P at 7,000 before the year's out, which would be monumental. But I am concerned about the rate of spending and the deficits we're producing. The president said, Thomas just sent this, I saw this as well. He said, for all cost-cutting Republicans, of which I am one, remember, you still have to get reelected. Don't go too crazy. We'll make it all up. Times 10 with growth more than ever before. Man, I hope the president's right. I really do. I really do. And because at this point, the cost cuts, which the parliamentarian already is shaky on, and I've always wondered this, is how much can we really do to these mandatory programs? Very limited. The parliamentarian spoke without 60 votes in the Senate. And really nothing of significance to Medicare and Social Security. The Medicare, little bit of reforms that would apply to those on Medicare and Medicaid, have the dual enrollment there. But not anything major and significant. I'm concerned about that as well, no doubt. I mean, it's just mathematical fact. We're on a $2.3 trillion deficit run rate this year. I see that continuing in the next 4 years. But it appears to me that this is the only way we can get the tax cuts extended. It's the only way the parliamentarian would let the tax cuts get extended. And we're limited by the parliamentarian on what we can cut. So, yeah, you can pound the table and jump up and down like Rand Paul does all day long. But you know what? Until you convince some Democrats to go your way and the whole Republican conference in the Senate to get 60, you can't do anything significant. And the president's right. You start talking about making significant cuts to material cuts to those programs, Social Security and Medicare, that's a recipe for getting your picture taken off the wall, as they say. You need people that are willing to make those tough decisions that are okay with coming home. I did the right thing. I'm coming home. And far too few of those. So I saw the Patty Murray, the senator from Washington. She's all mad. I don't know if I can find her exact quote. But she's all mad, Rhino, because of the way the parliamentarian is scoring the legislation. She says that's never been done before, and it's unprecedented. And of course, it's a concern for her because it would allow the legislation to pass muster with respect to passing with a simple majority. Well, she said something that caught my eye. She said, in my 33 years of being in the Senate, I've never seen that before. Does that just not describe the fundamental problem right there? You've been there 33 freaking years. I've never seen this in 33 years. That's the problem there, Toots.
Just a few generations ago to have been in the Senate for three decades, you either had to be brilliant or crooked as a dog's leg.
Well, she's surely brilliant. We got the final segment coming up next. Stay with us.
Poly up a Mississippi.
Are we going to do this?
Middays with Gerard Gibbert.
Keep rolling. 3, 2, 1.
On Super Talk Mississippi.
Welcome back, everyone. It's Middays. We're in the Element Well studio. I almost ran off the road when I just heard crooked like a dog's leg. Way to go, Rhino. What does a parliamentarian do? That term just kind of showed up the last few days, says Brian in Clarksdale. No, it's been out there. Both chambers have a parliamentarian, and their job is just to make sure that all of the work, all the proceedings that occur in the respective houses in the Capitol are done in accordance with the rules. So there are rules adopted by each of the chambers that are passed, if you will, that are used to govern the action and the activities in the House and in the Senate. In this case, in the Senate at least, one of their more controversial responsibilities, not that the responsibility is controversial, but what they are responsible for in this regard is, and that is when a bill qualifies to pass in the Senate with a simple majority as opposed to passing with a filibuster-proof majority, which requires 60 votes to end the filibuster to proceed. And that is a rule that is adopted and put in place in the Senate. It could be changed. You could end the filibuster with a simple majority vote in the Senate, in which case the parliamentarian would not have to review legislation for its eligibility, for its qualifying to pass with a simple majority, because there would be no filibuster that could stand in the way, that could block it. That's been in place for a while. Mitch McConnell, as the leader, he wouldn't end it. Senator Thune, he won't end it either. And that, again, is not guaranteed you'd get the necessary 51 votes to do it. Now, on the other hand, Chuck Schumer tried. We talked about it numerous times, as you recall, Rhino. He tried, and it was two Democrats that stood in the way. Again, you remember during the Biden administration in the Senate, it's 50-50. 50 Democrats, 50 Republicans, the vice president being the tiebreaker. With a vote of 51 to, it would be 50 in this case, they could have ended the filibuster. But standing in the way were two senators, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona, who's now an independent. Joe Manchin, the Democrat. He said, no, I don't support. And that's why they couldn't end the filibuster. And guys, if they could have ended the filibuster, it would have opened the floodgates for a barrage of really bad legislation the Democrats wanted to pass, starting with federalizing elections in this country. That was the first thing they wanted to do, making D.C. and Puerto Rico a state. All kinds of other stuff would have happened had they ended the filibuster. And that particular rule means that you got a much higher bar to cross to pass legislation in the Senate, except that legislation, which qualifies under reconciliation rules, but it's the which only requires a simple majority. But the parliamentarian has to step in and say, "Yep, that is eligible." Specific provisions within a bill have to meet those requirements. And what she has ruled here recently, Elizabeth McDonough, the Senate parliamentarian, is that some of the Medicaid reforms in the bill do not qualify, and those have been stripped out at this point. Could pass if you could get 60 votes. That means you'd have to get all Republicans and peel off 7 Democrats. Not likely, honestly. So that's shaping the legislation. Byrd of West Virginia started the parliamentarian position. No, I don't think he started the parliamentarian position. He started the reconciliation process. Parliamentarian's always been around. We've always had to have...
Well, it's not always, but it's been named the parliamentarian since the 30s,
okay.
I want to say.
Well, long as I can remember, thanks for clarifying that.
I want to say it originally started off as an assistant to the head of the Senate, which is the vice president, but that also came during a time period where the winner became the president, and if you came in second, you got vice president.
Well, so let me clarify that. I think the point is somebody was reviewing the rules and making sure stuff went according to rules. It just
may
not
have been a lot. Fewer rules.
Yeah, and you may not have had a dedicated person, as we do since the 30s, the so-called parliamentarian, just to make sure you're doing things. And you know, along those lines, Rhino, just in board meetings, it's common to have an attorney present that understands the bylaws that the board is bound to, that tells you how you have to proceed on certain things, because you want to do things in accordance with the bylaws or constitution of an organization, plus Robert's Rules of Orders, which are adopted in the bylaws and all that sort of stuff. We're out of here today. Back with you again tomorrow. Until then, stay safe and God bless everyone.
A Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.